Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Last year, more than 37,000 people were diagnosed with cancer here in Wisconsin. That's according to the American Cancer Society. And odds are cancer has affected your life in some way, and it's also likely you've run into myths about cancer. And we're going to be talking about cancer misconceptions to begin the show today with our guest, Sarah Cotilla. She is the Clinical Trials Navigator Manager at the UW-Carbone Cancer Center. Sarah's leading a workshop on the misinformation around clinical trials at UW Health's annual Fall Cancer Conference. And we want to hear from you. When you hear a fact about cancer, how do you recognize misinformation? Or maybe you're curious about how clinical trials are conducted. Give us your questions and comments. Maybe you've experienced a clinical trial or had a loved one. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Sarah Cotilla, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for having me. It's a great opportunity to be here and share this information with you and your listeners.
Well, I tell you what, you're a clinical trials navigator manager at UW-Carbone Cancer Center, which is, by the way, a mouthful. it's a job I'm curious about. What are you responsible for?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're correct. It is a mouthful, Larry. So I am, to simplify it, I am a nurse and I work in the Clinical Trials Navigation Office at the University of Wisconsin Carbone Cancer Center. So what my team and I do is we help provide education, outreach, and resources to patients, families, and referring providers around clinical trials. We also help pre-screen or review patients' information, their medical information, to see if they could potentially be eligible for a clinical trial at UW-Carbone.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's worth it to define what a clinical trial actually is. I mean, I think all of us have some sort of idea about it, but in your mind, what is a clinical trial?
Yeah, clinical trials really are studying new treatments for disease in human participants. But, you know, as far as clinical trials in cancer care, we're looking to improve our current treatments, whether that be from an outcome measure of how people respond to treatments or even to make the treatments more tolerable from a side effect and toxicity standpoint.
How do you decide... Or maybe I shouldn't put it that way. How do you help your patients decide whether to participate in a clinical trial?
That's a great question, Larry. So I think what I share with patients and providers are that clinical trials are other treatment options that patients can always consider. So anytime a patient needs a new treatment, there could be standard of care treatments or the standard that's been used to treat a certain type of cancer, but there may also be clinical trials that are out there that are looking at new ways to treat cancer. And I think that, you know, clinical trials are always optional. That's something for patients to keep in mind. No one can ever force you to go on a clinical trial or make you participate. It's an option to consider. And sometimes clinical trials can give patients more options for treatment.
Yeah, I had a friend who went through a clinical trial at UW about 8 years ago. His thought was, he had pancreas cancer, fourth stage. And his thought was maybe it wouldn't help him, but he felt like it maybe helped somebody else down the road.
And I think you really hit the nail on the head. I think participating in a clinical trial is really a personal choice. You know, of course, most people want a treatment that's going to help them, but I do think that some people think, you know, I would like to contribute to science and to help those that come after me with these kind of diagnoses and how we improve the treatment. And I think another important topic to just touch on briefly, besides the fact that clinical trials are always voluntary in nature, is that There's a lot of myths out there that clinical trials are only a last resort, and that's not true. There can be clinical trials at any stage of cancer treatment, and it can be for early or late stage disease. It can be pre or post-surgical, but I always encourage patients and their providers to kind of take a pause and look anytime there's a fork in the road of a patient's treatment or a new diagnosis to see what all the options are out there.
There have to be some ethical considerations in place when there's a clinical trial.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, part of what will be discussed at the Fall Cancer Conference are there are a lot of misinformation, myths, and misbeliefs out there around cancer care. I think some of them have stemmed from things that have happened historically and things that we need to acknowledge probably weren't done in the most ethical manner. But today we have a number of checks and balances for patients that are going to go on clinical trials. You know, we have our medical ethics team, our institutional review boards, all these people that are checking to make sure that, you know, minimal risks are being undertaken on clinical trials and that the benefits are outweighing the risks and that we're, you know, minimizing any potential harms to patients.
And what's it like for the patient to be part of it?
Absolutely. I don't know that I can fully answer that because I'm not a patient and I think everybody's individual experience is different. But I think that what a patient can expect is they're going to have a team of, you know, their healthcare provider and many research staff that are overseeing their care and really making sure that they're checking in and they're, you know, following along with the patient's care to see how they're doing and how the treatment's working.
So as you've indicated, there's a large amount of misinformation surrounding cancer there, and there are countless stories about a new cure, a new treatment, or maybe there's a new suspected carcinogen. I can think of examples in both of those cases. Why is that?
You know, I think some of the misinformation and myths do stem to things that have happened historically. I think I would be amiss not to acknowledge that there have been awful experiences in clinical research historically. You could think back to World War II when the Nazis performed unethical experimentation on prisoners in the concentration camps. Even more recently, you know, a well-known unethical study is the Tuskegee syphilis incident where black men were told they were just being treated for bad blood and actually they were following them for syphilis. And when a cure became available, it was never given to them. So I think that a lot of the misinformation and myths may stem from things and the mistrust in the medical community that's happened because of some of these historical events.
Yeah, I was thinking about a couple that I know or knew. The wife had cancer, and it was terminal, and there was a treatment being proposed out of Mexico, I believe it was, that the doctors told the husband that and the wife that this was not going to help, that it was in fact a scam. But the wife still wanted to do it, and the husband just put his foot down on it. And he later told me, he says, it's the only argument we ever had in our whole marriage. And he felt so bad about that particular circumstance. They didn't do it, and she passed away. But she was going to pass away regardless. And it could have been a very, very tough time. So when you have misinformation, you know, when there are things out there like that, the toll that it takes on the families can be horrendous.
Absolutely. And I think you really hit an important point here, Larry, is that, you know, especially in cancer care, people people want a cure, and people that need a cure are vulnerable. And there's a lot of information out there in anything in media right now, but especially in cancer and cancer care. And I think it's hard for people to dig through, you know, what's true, what's not true. I think even when you look back historically, you know, 100 years ago at the beginning of the 20th century, part of the reason the FDA was formed was they were looking at misbranded and lower quality items that were being sent across states and trying to get a handle on that. And even in 1937, after, you know, 100 and some people died of a solvent that was used in an elixir, the Federal Drug and Cosmetics Act came about to try to make people look and test the safety of items so that they weren't just being sold alternatives that were not helpful and potentially lethal.
So what are some other misinformation, examples of misinformation or myths around cancer in clinical trials?
Yeah, so I think one of the big ones that probably a lot of people have heard, is that, you know, there's a cure for cancer and that the big pharmaceutical companies are hiding that so that they can continue to make money off of cancer treatment. And I think, you know, when you really break that down on a number of levels, you know, that statement in general would go against a lot of moral and ethical obligations in the healthcare community. It would directly go against the Hippocratic Oath that the physicians take. And I think on a personal level, you know, everybody knows someone with cancer. And so it would really conflict with personal interest and also just our life's work. But, you know, even for people that still question it, there was a gentleman by the name of David Robert Grimes that in 2016, he was a physicist and cancer researcher at Oxford. And he looked into models of like conspiracy theories and looked at the number of people that would be involved and the duration that those secrets could be kept. And, you know, a lot of work goes into cancer research and finding treatments. And what they've seen is that, you know, by his calculations, which were, you know, good estimates, that around 714,000 people would have to be involved if there was a cure for cancer. And, you know, by his modeling, he looked at how long it would take for someone to spill the beans, per se, on that. And some of the modeling was used off of things. You know, a lot of times there's not information on conspiracy theories, but it was used from things like the Tuskegee incident and all of and other things like Snowden's NSA exposure. And so he found things like, you know, it would take less than 1,250 people to keep a secret for 10 years. And I think when you see that information and that modeling, even statistically, it would be really hard to keep that a secret if it were true. I think other myths that are out there are some that I've mentioned already, you know, that clinical trials are a last resort, that trials mean no hope, that a clinical trial won't help me. I've had people say, you know, I need treatment, not a placebo. I don't want to be a guinea pig, you know, and things like that, that I really try to share information and educate people around what the truth is about those statements.
Well, in a clinical trial, is there a placebo?
So that's a great question. I think clinical trials in general can use placebos. In clinical trials in cancer care, we rarely use placebos. Yeah. It would be unethical to not treat someone that needed a treatment for cancer. I think that when placebos are used in cancer clinical trials, often it's when you're doing randomized comparison on the clinical trial of maybe somebody, you know, a certain cohort or arm of the clinical trial is being treated with the standard of care. And maybe the trial is looking at if we add a new medicine to our standard of care, will it make the outcomes better? And so that's really where placebos are often used in cancer treatment trials.
And the average person might say, well, why do you need a placebo?
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there's different phases in clinical trials. That's another thing that you know, I don't know how many people know about, but the phases in clinical trials are actually the steps that new drugs go through to be approved as standard treatments. And so the first phase in a clinical trial is really looking at safety and dosing. You know, what are the potential side effects? What is the maximum dose we can give a patient with the minimal amount of side effects? How do we give the medicine? Is it IV? Is it by mouth? Once we find a lot of that information, the second phase is looking at, you know, now that we know how to give this medication and what some of the side effects are, does it work in certain types of cancer? You know, does it work in pancreatic cancer? Does it work in breast cancer? And if it does, that's when it goes to the third step in a clinical trial or a phase three clinical trial, where it looks at, does this new treatment potentially work as good or better than what we have as a standard treatment? And so to really get an answer to that, you have to have a randomized comparison to see, does it work as good or better than what we have for patients currently? And you know, to reiterate, working as good or better can mean in terms of outcomes or you know, the side effect profile for the patients.
Our guest today, Sarah Cotilla, the Clinical Trials Navigator Manager at the UW Carbone Cancer Center, visiting with her about addressing misinformation about cancer. It's great to have her with us today. And you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're addressing misinformation about cancer on the show today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Sarah Cotilla, Clinical Trials Navigator Manager at the UW Carbone Cancer Center. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Louise in Dodgeville. Louise, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, I was wondering if your guest could speak to kind of like the leading edge of cancer research, kind of like DNA sequencing of cancer cells and using a patient's like immune system to fight cancer, it almost treating it like a virus, and if she has any insights on that.
Are there trials going on in that area?
Yes, thank you for that question, Louise. So you hit something important to talk about is that, you know, cancer treatment has evolved over the years. Historically, chemotherapy, surgery, radiation were the main treatments that were used for cancer care. And as many people saw and know, chemotherapy not only kills the bad cells in cancer and the fast-growing tumor cells, but it can kill other fast-growing healthy cells, which is why people, you know, have problems with their stomach and nausea and losing their hair and things like that. And what we've found through the years is that there are more targeted ways to treat cancer. Something that we look at right now in clinical trials is that we're looking at, you know, could a patient be eligible based on the genomic mutations in their cancer for targeted treatment? And what the targeted treatment can do is it can target the drivers in those mutations or the drivers of the cancer. So one way to think of that is, you know, historically we treated cancer based on the site it originated from. You know, you treat a breast cancer like a breast cancer, pancreatic like a pancreatic cancer. But what we've found through the years and through some of this genomic testing is that some of these cancers have similar mutations that can drive their cancer. And so if you have a breast cancer and a pancreatic cancer that have a similar mutation, you may treat them with the same targeted medication versus just treating it on the site of origination to help focus on what is driving that cancer. Immunotherapy is another important new treatment that has come about in you know, recent times. And that's been important too, because that really revs up a patient's immune system to help recognize the cancer and hopefully, you know, rev up the immune system to attack the cancer. And it has different toxicity and side effect profiles. And that's important to keep searching out for patients to find better outcomes and less toxicities.
Yeah, Louise, thanks. Good question. Thank you so much for calling. And again, you can join us 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. What role can health professionals play in combating cancer misinformation?
That's a great question, Larry. I think there's so much out there. And, you know, as I worked on my talk for our upcoming conference, I thought about the drivers of misinformation, myths and misbeliefs that are out there. And I think that, you know, there's so many things and so many resources are at our fingertips right now. You know, there used to be a lot, and you certainly are more of an expert on this than me, but there used to be more print media. There used to be, you know, more editors and checks and balances and a lot of media resources. And of course, with the rise of social media and influencers and all that, I think that, you know, information can get out there quicker and be at people's fingertips. And so it's really important to look at the sources, you know, to look at, is it good medical information? I think a lot of times, you know, when news and media put out stories, they kind of simplify it. And so it doesn't talk about, you don't hear about like the research that went on before that or the research that failed. You're just hearing about the breakthroughs. And so I think it is hard to decipher that, but we, at the University of Wisconsin in my office, are always providing patients and family members with resources for information around cancer, but also clinical trials, and really are looking to continue that outreach, whether it be, you know, through talking at support groups or printed material or whatever it may be. We really recognize the need to be viewed as Wisconsin's cancer resource and to help people find that information that they're looking for.
What, or I should say, how can misinformation about cancer affect people's decisions about their health? I mean, I gave an example, I think, a little earlier, but I mean, this can have disastrous effects.
It can. And I think, you know, unfortunately, a great recent example of that is, you know, with the COVID pandemic, a lot of people were scared to get the vaccination, and it was affecting a lot of minority populations, you know, five times as much as it was affecting others. And I think because of, you know, the history of mistrust and distrust in the medical community, it really played a part in some of the misinformation that was, you know, out there and the misbeliefs. But I think we need to acknowledge that and do a better job of trying to help people understand how clinical research has evolved and what the checks and balances are, and that it is voluntary in nature, and that a patient always has a choice of whether they want to participate in something. But I think really continuing to seek out resources is an important part of it, and making sure those resources are reliable.
Jean in Ladysmith, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jean.
Hi. This is pertaining to the immunotherapy discussion and the very good questions that the lady just asked a couple of minutes ago. I am a survivor of colon cancer as of 1 year ago, and my tumor was one of those genetic tumors that responds a little better to immunotherapy than it does to conventional chemotherapy. And my doctors tried to get me into a clinical trial, but up here in northern Wisconsin, it's kind of limited as to our opportunities. They have them, but we were too late in applying because of the timing of when they diagnosed my cancer. And so I did conventional chemotherapy. Unfortunately, I am in remission, but I had some side effects that are semi-permanent or permanent. And I wondered, he said that immunotherapy is on the verge of being approved as a standard therapy that would be covered by medical insurance and not have to be a clinical trial. And I wondered if she had any idea what was going on with that or how I can help.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Jean, and I'm glad to hear you're doing well right now. And I have a personal interest in the piece you speak about of being a good distance from a cancer center. I grew up not far from you in small town of Chautauqua, Wisconsin. Mm. And, you know, it is something from a treatment standpoint that you look at. A lot of these clinical trials are available at big academic medical centers, and not everybody has access to those geographically or financially. And I think it's important that we continue to look at ways that we can decentralize clinical trials. That's been something, you know, new that we've talked about in cancer care in general. How do we get the trials to the patients? And I think we continue to look at that. I think as far as, you know, when a treatment is approved, as in immunotherapy, it depends on the disease, it depends on the use for it. And I think that, you know, oftentimes those clinical trials, like I mentioned, are going through the steps or phases to finally send an application to the FDA to have it approved as a standard treatment. And the clinical trials are what are giving us the information that is something that should happen. And so I think, you know, it's important that we have patients participate in clinical trials, because it gives us that information to be able to bring these new treatments to patients as standard treatments, so they're not having to travel and they can be available to everyone.
Yeah. Jean, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jeff wonders, are people ever paid for participating in clinical trials?
That's a great question. So as anytime a patient or a person decides they want to participate in a clinical trial, they'll go through something called an informed consent process. And during the informed consent process, you'll hear about things like, you know, what is the purpose of the study? Why did they decide they wanted to run this clinical trial? What are the potential risks and benefits? Are there alternatives to going on the trial? And also you can hear about, you know, what are some of the logistics? You know, how often do I have to be seen? How is the medication given? But in that, you'll hear if there's any costs or any compensation for clinical trials. I think that historically, you know, that's been an ethical question to consider too, because you don't want to coerce people into participating in clinical trials by paying them. But I would argue on the flip side that sometimes having, you know, financial compensation for participants on clinical trials can equalize the playing field a little bit, where, you know, maybe if people are having to travel, as Jean was just saying, living a good distance from the hospital where trials are being run, or people have to take time off work or they need childcare, that can equalize the playing field for a lot of people. And I think the other piece that we look at nowadays too is that, you know, we do rely on participants and volunteers for clinical trials. And so sometimes healthy volunteers take part in clinical trials, not necessarily cancer treatment trials, but, you know, new drug trials, those phase one trials, and they are often paid for their participation, and sometimes quite well. And so kind of trying to, you know, talk about dispelling the myth of you're not a guinea pig in a clinical trial. There are now people that are self-professed professional guinea pigs, or self-proclaimed professional guinea pigs. And they use that as, you know, they're getting paid kind of to endure something versus produce something. And that is what they do. They'll jump around trying to find clinical trials and being reimbursed for them. And I think there's a lot of questions around the ethics of that, and just, you know, how the constructs are set up and what implications that could have as well.
And typically, if you're involved in a clinical trial, the clinical trial portion of that is, you're not going to be paying for that.
No, people ask about that a lot, and that's a great question. Like, what are the costs associated with participating in a clinical trial? And you know, I'm certainly not the financial expert or the insurance expert on all of this, but they're kind of broken down in two ways. There's some costs that are considered research, and then there's some costs that are considered kind of standard of care costs. So anything that pertains to the research, whether it's the study medication, whether the study requires that, you know, a person have serial EKGs with their heart rhythm to study the medication. Some of those things will be covered under research and paid for by the clinical trial sponsor. On the flip side, things that a patient would need regardless of whether they're on a clinical trial or not, like, you know, maybe if they were getting imaging for their or x-rays and CTs for their disease every 8 weeks, regardless of whether they're on a clinical trial or not, that would continue to be billed to the patient's insurance. And so that's kind of how the costs break apart. Anytime a clinical trial is being built, you're trying to limit the out-of-pocket expenses that could fall on a patient. But of course, as we know, in the U.S., everybody's insurance varies so much and can dictate, you know, where patients can be seen for treatment, and just their coverage can be different at different places and based on their insurance in general.
Yeah, makes sense. You know, a minute or two ago, you mentioned guinea pigs. How do we associate, or why do we associate guinea pigs with clinical trials?
That's a great question. And the guinea pig got pulled into it a long time ago, Larry. So I think that, you know, guinea pigs were actually first introduced and originated from South America near the Andes, and the Incas were the first people that kind of domesticated them. They eventually came with traders, you know, Spanish and Dutch and English traders. And I would say by the 17th century, they started using them in some clinical trials. And definitely, you know, they have a lot of similarities is what they've found to humans in some things like their response to allergens, their immune systems, their hearing and ear structures. And so that's kind of how they started being used. I think that the use of guinea pigs in general has decreased as an animal subject in clinical trials, as they've found animals that are, you know, less costly. Mice are less costly, animals that breed quicker and have more offspring. But that's kind of, you know, by the early 20th century, I think that's where that terminology kind of originated from. And, you know, now, of course, as much as we try to do away with it, I don't know if there's, it's swung the whole pendulum here, because I don't know if there's any term maybe more offensive than calling a clinical trial participant a guinea pig. But now there's people that are self-proclaimed guinea pigs. And so it continues to kind of pervade discussions around clinical trials. But certainly patients are not guinea pigs. They are human participants, and they have their own free will and autonomy in how they decide how what their treatment choices are. And we certainly have a number of ethical, legal, medical checks and balances to make sure that participants are treated as humans and not thought of as guinea pigs.
Well, that reminds me, just thinking about the history of trials. I mean, were the guinea pigs among the first what's the history of trials?
Yeah. So clinical trials are actually found throughout history in a number of different historical writings. You know, even in the Bible, I think it was in the book of Daniel, there was a king. His name was, he was a king and military leader, and his name was King Nebuchadnezzar. Yes. And he had decided that to keep, you know, his community healthy, he wanted them to drink wine and eat meat. And so kind of unknowingly, some of the royal subjects objected and said they wanted to eat, you know, legumes and water. And kind of at the end, he let it go. And at the end of this trial, he actually saw that they were healthier than the people that had eaten meat and drank wine. And I think, you know, you see it even coming further into, you know, in 1747, Dr. James Lind was a doctor on ships that were coming across the sea and seeing all these sick sailors and, you know, the scurvy issues. And he really tried different nourishments for these sailors, and found that adding, you know, lemons and oranges help cure some of these sailors of scurvy. And so I think there is a lot of history and kind of, you know, that scientific inquisitiveness that has prevailed throughout history, and sometimes unknowingly, but I think sometimes just asking, you know, the question of what if we did this, would it make a difference and propel us to better outcomes for things?
Sarah Cotilla is the Clinical Trials Navigator Manager at the UW-Carbone Cancer Center. Great to have her with us today. Questions for her or comments, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today, we'll cover what you need to know about lung and pancreas transplantation and why Wisconsin Transplant Program is ranked best in the nation. Right now, we're taking a look at cancer and addressing misinformation about it with our guest, Sarah Cotilla, Clinical Trials Navigator Manager at the UW-Carbone Cancer Center. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Dennis in Green Bay, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, Larry, I'm calling in because I've had family members have cancer, but one of the things that people who are suffering from cancer and start on chemo is the need for platelets. People who are on chemo oftentimes have their platelet production almost eliminated with the chemo. So they need platelets in order to continue on chemo. And donating platelets really helps those people stay on their chemo and fight their cancer. And platelets only last 5 days, so people need to donate on a regular basis. And with all the people that are touched by cancer, I'm encouraging them to look into donating platelets so people on chemo can continue their treatment.
Well, Dennis, thank you for calling. Comment, Sarah.
Yes, it's super important. Thank you for pointing that out and bringing it to attention. We know that there are side effects when patients go through cancer treatment, and what the caller touched on is one of those is that, you know, chemotherapy can kill those fast-growing cells, which can include some of the patient's blood cells, you know, hemoglobin, with the red cells and the platelets. And so they do need transfusions of those. And it is important. And I thank you for putting in the plug for blood and platelet donation, because it's important for these patients to be able to receive those and be able to continue on the treatment they need for their cancer.
Yeah. Thank you, Dennis. Appreciate your call. I want to turn back to the trials a bit about words. What role do words play in the outcomes of clinical trials? I think everything has to be fairly carefully done.
Yeah, I think words are important in how we share information about clinical trials. You know, I think calling patients subjects versus participants, pointing out the voluntary and optional nature of clinical trials is important. I think you know, sometimes the fear is like, what are the side effects going to be? And I think, you know, there can be side effects on clinical trials, but there can be side effects with any cancer treatment. And so really helping patients to understand with the words we use, but also making sure that they're feeling heard and that they're feeling we're looking at them as an individual and a person, you know, that we're not just looking at, you know, even how we discuss their disease, you know, a pancreas cancer patient versus a person with pancreatic cancer. They're a person first, and it takes the focus off the disease and on the person. And I think that's important as we look at, you know, how do we provide good support? How do we build the trust? How do we continue our outreach and education with patients and families?
And I suppose it might be possible, or it could be possible, that the words that the clinicians use to the patients could maybe have an effect on the outcome of a trial.
I think it definitely could have an outcome in that, you know, a trial's success is definitely dependent on trial participation. And I think if a patient feels like they're getting the information they need and they can trust the person that's sharing the information, it can help us, you know, enroll patients on clinical trials. It can help them find new treatments, and it can help us bring clinical trial success about as a standard treatment, you know, if we find that some of these new drugs or treatments are working for patients.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm wondering, I mean, you have a whole raft of information, I'm sure, but how can the public be better educated and informed about cancer trials and cancer treatments?
Yeah, there's a number of different types of information that are out there. A lot of people, of course, are on the internet nowadays. But, you know, the National Cancer Institute is a great resource for all things cancer related, whether it's a diagnosis or side effects, or they have information on clinical trials. Here at Carbone, we have our own clinical trials website that patients can access. And that is a resource that we give to patients. We also, part of what we do in my office is that we provide patients and families with information around clinical trials, whether it be information from our center or general sites for searching for clinical trials. If we don't have anything available at UW-Carbone, there are other sites out there where patients can continue to search for clinical trials. And so all those are important sites for us to share with patients. And we also interact at different tabling events at with our handouts and things like that with patients, and you know, can share information in a number of avenues that we attend as well.
And that brings me to the conference that we've sort of mentioned in kind of in passing almost. I know you're speaking at the UW Health's annual Fall Cancer Conference. Tell us more about the conference.
Yeah, so this is the 22nd annual Fall Cancer Conference, and it was started again as we recognize at UW-Carbone that we need to be viewed as Wisconsin's cancer resource. We wanted to be able to share best practices not only with our own staff, but also healthcare professionals throughout the state, as well as patients, family members, and caregivers. You know, we're not only treating the patients, but we do offer cutting-edge research here. And it's our charge to really make sure that we're educating and informing our the public about prevention, screening, best practices, treatment, research, and advocacy. So over the years, over the 22 years, there's been a number of different topics that are kind of the theme of the cancer conference. You know, they've done stuff on rural medicine and palliative care and survivorship. And this year, the theme is misinformation, myths, and misbeliefs. And, you know, it's just because cancer misinformation has become increasingly prevalent and a problem that can potentially endanger public health and understanding. And so that's what this year's conference will focus on. It is open to the public. It is going to be held Friday, October 18th at the Monona Terrace in Madison. If anybody is interested in attending, they are taking walk-up registration the day of at the Monona Terrace. It is a $40 registration fee that includes breakfast and lunch. And the conference will run kind of from that check-in and breakfast until closing from about 7:15 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon.
Give us an example of the, I'm sure you're going to be talking about misinformation as it relates to clinical trials. What all are we going to hear about?
Yeah, so I really want to touch on a couple of things, Larry. I think it's important that we first talk about some of the stuff we've talked about already, but, you know, what are the myths and misinformation and misbeliefs that are out there around cancer and clinical trials? You know, how is that information spread? What are some of the drivers of that information? I want to delve a little bit more into the historical perspectives on clinical trials, you know, that lead to mistrust and some of those myths and misbeliefs. You know, we talked a little bit already, but why the guinea pig metaphor? You know, why did that come about? What has that taught us? What has history taught us? And I think that it's important to look at the lessons learned from history. You know, what have we learned from some of these important historical events? And then really also continuing to talk about the words and the language and how we do better going forward. You know, what do we need to do to plant the seeds of trust and to plant the seeds of information? What questions should we continue to ask ourselves to help clinical research continue to evolve and help people get you know, the right information at the time they need it?
You know, clinical trials, give us some, can you give me an example or two of clinical trials that have really resulted in great things?
I can, and I can give you a personal example, actually. So I also like to tell people that clinical trials are important, even for people that are not on a clinical trial themselves. So I told you that the new treatments we get come from clinical trials. Well, my grandmother, my grandma Jenny, at the age of 84, was diagnosed with bladder cancer. And because of her age, she went through some of the standard treatments of, you know, they resected some of it, they tried infusing some things into her bladder. They actually ended up removing her bladder at one point and creating kind of a new pathway for her body to, you know, excrete waste through a ureostomy bag. And her cancer still came back, and it had metastasized, and it was stage 4. And based on her age at the time, she wouldn't have been eligible for a lot of our standard of care options like chemotherapy. And luckily, you know, when she had been found to become metastatic, it was June of that year. And in April and May of that year, they had just approved through clinical trials, because they were seeing such great success, immunotherapy for use in patients that weren't eligible to receive the standard of care chemotherapy. So my grandma Jenny, because it was perfect timing, was able to go on immunotherapy, not on a clinical trial, but because it had just been approved through clinical trials. And 12 weeks after she went on immunotherapy, she was found to have no evidence of the disease. And wow. This was at the age of 84 with a stage 4 bladder cancer, was found to have no evidence of disease. Larry, she lived another 7 years and died cancer-free because of that treatment. And, you know, it really gave us hope. It really gave us time. And my kids a whole opportunity to know her in a different time frame than had she not had that treatment option when she was diagnosed and found to be metastatic.
Wow. That is wonderful. Last year, Sarah, you received the Healthcare Hero Award from the Wisconsin Cancer Collaborative, and congratulations.
Thank you.
As a nurse, you're with people as they experience a difficult period of life. How do you consistently provide compassionate care?
Thank you, first of all, for that. And yes, it was a great honor to receive that. I absolutely love what I do, Larry, and just feel so strongly about helping people with cancer understand all the treatment options that are out there. It is, you know, the worst time sometimes in a person's life to get a cancer diagnosis. And it's a privilege to be able to stand with them and help them through these trying times with information that can make a difference in their care and outcomes. And I think that, you know, I just wouldn't want to be any other place. This is yeah. My life's work to help these patients and their families and really continue to learn from them as much as we learn about cancer in general.
How long have you been doing this?
I have been a nurse for over 20 years, and I graduated from the UW-Madison School of Nursing, and the majority of my nursing career has been in caring for patients with cancer in one way or another. I have been in the clinical trials navigation office at Carbone since 2018, and our office has had tremendous success and a lot of growth with adding new staff and just seeing the need to continue to help patients with education and clinical trial opportunities. And again, I just feel so strongly about whatever we can do to move medicine and care for people forward is what we need to do.
Years ago, I had the pleasure and honor of interviewing Paul Carbone many times. It was an honor then, and it's an honor and privilege to be able to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Larry. I also want to thank you for the opportunity and the time today. This was wonderful. Thank you.
Sarah Cotilla, Clinical Trials Navigator Manager at the UW Carbone Cancer Center. She's doing some, and the whole center is doing some wonderful, wonderful things when it comes to cancer. Coming up, we're going to take a look at transplants, lung and pancreas transplants. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we are turning our attention to transplants and zeroing in on lung and pancreas transplants with our guests today from UW Health. One of them, Dr. John Odorico, is a general surgeon who specializes in kidney, pancreas, and islet cell transplant surgeries. Dr. Odorico, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Larry.
Great to have you here, and great to have Dr. Aaron Lowry with us as well, medical director of the UW Health Lung Transplant Program. Dr. Aaron Lowry, thank you for joining in.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be here.
As we talk with our guests today, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you received an organ donation, or have received a transplanted organ from a donor. Maybe that experience was great. Was it? Give us a call. Let us know. Is a loved one scheduled for an organ transplant soon? Want to hear from you. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm sure that in your line of work, you hear a lot of stories from people who have either given or received an organ. And I know we're going to hear from some callers this hour who are going to want to share their stories. But before we do that, I'm wondering if you can talk about the kinds of stories you hear on a day-to-day basis. Any story that really sticks out with you? I'll ask you both, but Dr. Aaron Lowry, start with you.
You know, the journey for transplant is a process, and for each individual patient, it's going to be unique, and it's going to be different. It's going to be their own journey. There's always going to be ups and downs throughout the course. There's going to be setbacks, and there's going to be great leaps ahead. What we hope for every patient who goes through the transplant process is that they're able to achieve their goals and the quality of life that they're seeking, to be able to participate in family events, in their community, spend more time with friends and family, and really get back to enjoying life.
Yeah, it makes sense. Dr. Odorico, a comment?
Well, we've heard some great stories over the years, Larry, as well. And patients are really engaged in their care, and then oftentimes would like to meet their donor family. And that is possible and is a really rewarding and meaningful experience for patients and the donor families. We've heard stories, many stories over the years about that. Patients are often living longer and longer after transplant. It's getting safer and safer. The outcomes are better and better as years go on. And, with patients, getting a chance to meet their family, they can celebrate their 10th, 15th, 25th year anniversary after transplant, which is really phenomenal. Having a chance to live a more fulfilled life.
It is indeed. And here you are, both part of nationally ranked transplant programs. And it was just some amazing figures on the success of both of these programs. What's the, and the, it's got to be super important to have programs like yours in Wisconsin?
Yes. I mean, what it is it provides an opportunity for patients to achieve the best possible outcomes. And particularly with the pancreas transplant program, we've been a consistently high-performing program, and this is not the first time we've had accolades in terms of quality and excellence. In fact, in 2019, we received the Interlake Interlink Center of Excellence Award for a top-performing pancreas transplant program by their holistic criteria in 2019. So, but what it does is give patients confidence that they are going to have success. You know, with any major surgery like a transplant, there is a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of fear about what might happen. It's complicated in terms of the surgery and managing patients. And we have an army of team managing patients, but having success gives them, the patients, the confidence and relieves their anxiety after transplant that they're going to have an excellent outcome.
Yeah, it's amazing. Dr. Lowry, you know, I it's hard for me to imagine somebody saying to me, you need a lung transplant. That is about as scary a prospect as I can almost think of. What are you doing better than other programs? You obviously are.
Well, Larry, you're right. Hearing that message, you need a lung transplant, is kind of a life changing event for our patients. Really can be very scary. It could be a period of time where patients are in denial or scared or hesitate just because of the gravity of the situation, how big of an operation and how big of an endeavor it can be. However, what our team strives to do is really approach each individual patient and help them walk through the journey. So we partner with the patient and their family and try and demystify the process and make it less scary, more accessible, and are there for them to explain every step of the way. Focusing on, optimizing their condition before we even get to the surgery. Can we physically get a little bit stronger, better nutrition, better mental health support? All of those things are important going into the surgery so that they face less complications after the surgery. It all comes down to the team, though. It takes a village to get through transplant.
Yeah.
We do a great job of having that village to support the patient and their family through the process.
I'm going to ask you both this, but what conditions lead to someone needing, since we're talking with you, Dr. Lowry, let's just talk about lungs for a minute. What conditions lead someone needing a lung transplant?
So the most common indications are pulmonary disease that result in lung transplant include idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, interstitial lung disease, emphysema or COPD, and bronchiectasis, cystic fibrosis, along with that bronchiectasis, although the need in that population has gone down with some of the newer treatments, and then also pulmonary hypertension. Those are the most common indications.
Yeah. Thinking back to my grade school days with one of my friends in grade school, his sister had cystic fibrosis. And at that point, there wasn't a whole lot of hope.
Yeah, there was a new treatment that came out the end of 2019 that has really changed everything for CF patients. It's quite miraculous. The need for transplant has gone down drastically in that population. And the average median survival for a patient born today is in the 60s, so in the mid-60s.
Amazing. Well, what about pancreas transplant? What causes a person, or what causes are there that result in a person needing a pancreas transplant?
Excellent question, Larry. It's generally speaking diabetes. Now, there are many forms of diabetes. The most common indication is type 1 diabetes. These are patients who have early onset autoimmune diabetes. But type 2 diabetes is increasingly becoming an indication for patients who also have kidney failure and type 2 diabetes. There are other forms of diabetes, though, and we're pretty agnostic when it comes to offering a pancreas transplant for a patient with diabetes as to the cause. It doesn't really matter. If they're on insulin, then they very well may be eligible for a pancreas transplant. Another indication is if they've had their pancreas removed due to chronic pancreatitis and surgery or trauma, they can brittle diabetics, and they can have a pancreas transplant as well. And we've done it for that indication. So if a patient has loss of their awareness of their low blood sugars, our typical symptoms are sweatiness, tremulousness. But if patients pass out or have accidents or seizures due to low blood sugars, because of reduced awareness of the symptoms that come along with that, which tends to happen over time, then they are eligible for a pancreas transplant. If they're not doing well on insulin pumps and modern sensor technology as well, in general, if they just have severely erratic blood sugars that are and experiencing frequent lows or highs, emergency room visits or hospitalizations or the like, then they may be eligible. Now, the most common type of pancreas transplant is done in combination with a kidney transplant. And that's because diabetes is the leading cause of kidney disease in the United States. Those are called simultaneous pancreas kidney transplants. Same donor offers and provides, same deceased donor provides a kidney and a pancreas transplant, one kidney. And that's the most common type of pancreas transplant in the United States. The other types are a sequential pancreas after kidney transplant, meaning the patient had kidney failure in the first place, got a kidney transplant from a deceased donor or living donor, and then subsequently thereafter, if doing well, got a pancreas alone transplant. And the other, the last indication, which is one we're specialized in, is about half our transplants this past year, pancreas transplants, is those patients with normal kidney function who have severe hypoglycemic events, hypoglycemic unawareness. That means they can't sense their low blood sugars, not doing well on pump and sensor technology. And they have normal kidney function again, but and are only eligible for a pancreas alone transplant. So those are the three different types of transplants, and those are the eligibility criteria.
Oh, excellent. And on the lung side, the lung transplant side, Dr. Lowry, could you talk about that side?
So in terms of who's eligible?
Yeah.
Really anyone that is requiring oxygen due to lung disease is who we're looking to consider for lung transplant. So you need to have advanced lung disease. Typically, patients are being seen by a pulmonologist, but they might be seeing their primary care doctor for their lung disease and have exhausted all treatment options. We do like to see patients earlier on. So if you're on oxygen or it's been recognized that you have advanced lung disease and are considering lung transplant, that's the time to meet with the lung transplant team to learn about all of what is involved in lung transplant. It's a lot to learn about, and there's a lot to work on in preparing for the lung transplant surgery. So you want to get that started as soon as possible after recognizing that your lung disease is advanced and it's not going to get any better.
Taking a look today at pancreas transplants and at lung transplants with our two guests, Dr. Aaron Lowry and Dr. John Odorico from the University of Wisconsin Health. It's great to have them with us. And questions for them, you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. Have you been a donor? Have you received a transplant? We'd love to hear your experiences. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here visiting today with Dr. Aaron Lowry, Medical Director of the UW Health Lung Transplant Program, and Dr. John Odorico, who is General Surgeon at UW Health. He specializes in kidney, pancreas and islet transplant surgeries. It's great to have them with us today. And certainly, if you have a question, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Cindy in Stevens Point, we'll go to you. Cindy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. Question, in pancreas problems, if someone has pancreatic cancer, is a transplant ever an option?
So if someone has pancreatic cancer, is a pancreas transplant an option?
Thank you for that question, Cindy. The answer is generally no, but we'd certainly be willing to investigate further for that patient, particular patient. The reason is that pancreatic cancer is generally diagnosed late in life and with and is often fairly advanced at the time of diagnosis, with a poor prognosis. The question is not diabetes then, it's really cancer, and it just happens to be in the pancreas. So this is a common misnomer that a pancreas transplant is to replace a pancreas with cancer, but then the essential problem is the immunosuppressive medications can make the cancer grow faster and make it more difficult to treat. And with it already being advanced, it's generally not an indication. If there is a total pancreatectomy for a benign tumor of the pancreas and the patient is rendered cancer-free for a number of years and is a brittle diabetic, then they may be eligible for a pancreas transplant. But that's a pretty unique and unusual situation. It's generally type 1 or type 2 diabetes. Oh. But thank you for the question.
Yeah, thank you, Cindy, for that question. Michael emailed us. He's identified on his driver's license as an organ donor. Also think about donating his body to a medical school or other scientific use. Will his body be accepted if pieces are missing from prior donations to others in need of certain parts, or would he need to stop being an organ donor first? Interesting question. Dr. Lowry, have you got an idea on that one?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Michael. I think it's always important to bring awareness to organ donation. And so if you want to be an organ donor, important to let your friends and family know that and also sign your organ donation on your license. Typically at the time of your demise, it's at that point that they're testing the organs to see if they're healthy enough for use during transplant. And so rest assured that at that time, those sort of decisions will be made. There are many patients that maybe, the lungs might not be able to be donated, but there are other things such as the kidney or tissue or cornea that can be donated. There's a very individualized approach to organ and tissue donation.
Chris in Spooner has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. Thank you. Our three-year-old granddaughter was very recently diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, and they're going through the process. She has an insulin pump now, and she, of course, has a monitor. I'm wondering what, in the future, is there a chance for an islet cell transplant, or how would that work? Is there anything in the works?
And maybe before we even get in, Chris will certainly answer that question, but Dr. Odorico, maybe the UW Health Transplant Center is the only center in Wisconsin and one of the few in the nation performing islet cell transplantation or pancreatectomy, I think, transplantation. maybe explain that procedure and then relate to Chris's question about her child, her grandchild.
Sure. Well, yes. So we are the only center in Wisconsin and one of few in the nation that are performing what's called a total pancreatectomy with autologous islet transplantation. This involves removing the pancreas due for chronic pain and chronic pancreatitis, and then infusing the islets after extracting them in the laboratory, infusing them back into the patient. So this is for patients that have chronic pancreatitis and chronic pain, but do not want to be rendered insulin dependent or diabetic after their removal of the pancreas. So this is a little bit different than what the caller is asking.
Okay.
Her daughter has autoimmune diabetes at a very young age. She's very fortunate to have access to pump and sensor technology, which is the state of the art. And I strongly encourage her to continue to use those technologies to the best of her ability and the best of the technology's ability and optimize her care with avoiding highs and lows and using the technology to achieve a hemoglobin A1C or glycated hemoglobin in the target range that the American Diabetes Association and other associations recommend. This will keep her out of harm's way as she becomes a young adult and in terms of minimizing her risk for kidney disease, eye disease, nerve disease, et cetera. The question specifically was about islet transplantation, and I think that refers to islet allo transplantation. That is an islet from a cadaver donor, a deceased donor. Those, unfortunately, are not very common in the United States because insurance companies don't pay for it yet and Medicare doesn't pay for it. It may be coming down the road in the near future. It's much more commonly delivered in other countries where there's universal health care, Canada, the UK, other centers in Europe, other countries in Europe and Australia. Unfortunately, in the United States, for a variety of reasons, it's not very common for allo islet transplantation. However, I'll say there's quite a bit of promise on the horizon for stem cell-derived islets. And we are the only center in Wisconsin offering that therapy as part of a study and a clinical trial and an investigation. It's not proven therapy at the moment, but we have two patients that are now off insulin, having received that therapy. And this is really quite promising, I think, and is something these patients are grateful for, and the patients are excited about. It does not apply for children yet, so that hopefully will be coming down the road.
Okay, Chris, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Kathy in Middleton next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Larry. This is only somewhat related. I have a very close friend who is about to have a bone marrow transplant. Now, he lives in Milwaukee, and I live in Middleton, so, of course, there's a distance there. What can I do as a friend to help him?
All right, emotionally supporting someone going through a transplant. Well, Dr. Lowry, let's have you address that to begin with.
Yeah, thanks, Kathy. I think that's a great question. Friends and family members of patients undergoing transplant, no matter what that transplant is, need a lot of support during that period of time. And so there's probably a lot that you can do. One, I would start by asking your friend, what would be the most helpful way? I want to support your journey through transplant. give me some ideas. What are you struggling with that I might be able to take off your plate? Sometimes that's as easy as, hey, you know what? I have these plants at my house that need to be watered, and I'm going to be, you know, getting a transplant. So can you help me with some of this housework that needs to be done, or some meals, providing some meals, or gathering some funds together? Oftentimes patients have to relocate to a transplant center, and that is can be expensive. And so fundraising and pooling some funds together, getting some meals, getting some housework done is usually some of the best ways to help support friends and family going through transplant.
Yeah, there you go, Kathy. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. Joyce called, couldn't stay with us. She wants to thank the doctors who helped out her brother with a double lung transplant. They also did a great job of educating the family, Dr. Lowry.
Well, great. Family support is so vital to make lung transplant a success.
So double lung, I mean, are there single lung transplants?
Yeah. So there is either single lung, one lung transplant, or two lungs. And it's not well known that people only need one good lung to survive and have a good quality of life, actually. If you have one good lung, it does the job of exchanging oxygen and carbon dioxide. And we have many patients who received one lung and are alive 15, 20 years later on that one good lung. So the decision whether to pursue one lung or two lung is made after you go through evaluation testing for transplant. So you get lots of different tests and consults that show us how is your heart and lungs working. And if it is favorable to receive one lung, that might be an option for you. The surgery itself is a little easier, so therefore the recovery is a little quicker.
How long would you have to wait for a lung or a pair of lungs? I mean, what's the wait time? I'm going to ask Dr. Oderico, too, about pancreas as well, but let's go to the stay with the lungs for a minute.
So at UW Health, we have the quickest wait time in the country. Our average wait list time right now is 12 days waiting for a lung transplant. That will vary depending on your unique patient factors, particularly blood type and height that go into sizing the organ. But at UW Health, we're fortunate that our patients are able to get transplanted quickly. Usually with lung, patients are pretty sick going into the transplant. So getting that transplant quickly helps them do better after transplant.
And are they receiving lungs just from Wisconsin folks?
No. Right. That's a great question, Larry. Actually, the lungs come from all over the country. We have an allocation system now that's called continuous distribution. So you are on a national wait list, and the surgeons go out for the lungs and bring them back quickly and do the transplant surgery.
It's really great. I didn't realize it would be that short of a time period. Dr. Oderico, what about on the pancreas side?
Yes. So we have among the shortest wait times, if not the shortest wait time in the country as well. You can get your transplant faster here in Wisconsin at our program, UW Health Transplant Program. Not only were we the top-ranked pancreas program for survival, but also for getting a transplant faster. It's important to know, though, that wait times can vary a little bit by blood type and by how sensitized a patient is. That is, if they have antibodies to other donors from either transfusions, transplants, or pregnancies. So that can increase their wait time, but on average, it's 4 to 5 months. At other programs, regionally or nationally, it can be years and years. We do not want patients, and neither do they want to sit on the waiting list, waiting a long period of time and possibly succumbing to other problems. So we are very interested in transplanting patients fast and getting their transplant fast, and I think they appreciate that as well. One other point I'd mention is that if a patient is on another waiting list and they're waiting and waiting, they can be dual listed. What that means is that they can get on more than one list. Insurance generally pays for that. So they could be listed in anywhere else in the country and on our list as well. And one of the reasons, as Dr. Lowry mentioned, is that why we have short wait times is for the same reason. We've been importing pancreases from all over the country through the allocation system for years, not just relying on our own organs. And that shortens waiting times for patients. So we've been importing pancreases for patients with diabetes on our program ever since 1997. So quite a long period of time.
Indeed. Roxy, relating to pancreas, Roxy emailed us and says, how come a person that who has had a pancreas transplant have to be on prednisone, but a kidney transplant, you don't need prednisone?
Well, that's not necessarily the case. More and more now, we are doing pancreas transplants with two anti-rejection medicines with what's called early steroid withdrawal or steroid-free protocols. So that is possible these days. And where it wasn't possible 10, 15 years ago, it is now.
Jane in Sun Prairie, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Jane.
Oh, hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a question for regarding lung transplants. I'm 74 years old. I recently got a diagnosis of bronchiectasis. In addition to my already established diagnosis of asthma. And with the bronchiectasis, that's just really giving me difficulty to breathe. What is the likelihood that I could receive a lung transplant for my bronchiectasis?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So bronchiectasis is a disease that is near and dear to my heart. It is one of the diseases that I focus on. And so first and foremost, you want to make sure that your disease is being treated optimally, that you've got all of the therapies on board for bronchiectasis. And so making sure that your pulmonologist understands what all of the latest therapies are for bronchiectasis and that you're doing those as optimally as possible. After that, if it appears your lung disease is continuing to advance and you're needing support from oxygen or other devices that support your breathing, that's when we think about transplant for bronchiectasis. So in those cases, in order to understand if you're eligible for lung transplant, you need to meet with the lung transplant team. And so we do consult visits to start things off just so that we can get to know the patient and the patient can get to know us to understand would they be eligible and what would it take in order to qualify for a transplant itself.
Jane, does that help?
That helps. And where would I start? Who would I call to start this process?
Yeah. So if you're interested in looking up bronchiectasis experts, you can look at the UW Health website to look at the various pulmonologists there who specialize in bronchiectasis. And for lung transplant consults, there is actually a place on our website where patients can self-refer, and then a member of our team will give you a call back to start off the process.
All right, Jane, thank you. And the website, if you type in UW Health?
Yes.
UW Hospitals and Clinics, maybe? I'm not positive. I think it is. We'll post it on the Larry Mueller Show, WPR.org/Larry. We'll post it up there. But if you just type in UW Health or UW Hospitals, it's probably going to come up on your search.
You could Google lung transplant. Here is the website is uwhealth.org/treatments/lung transplant. And in the top right corner is where patients can click on to submit a referral.
All right. Jane, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. We'll post that on our site as well. Somebody else wondered, how healthy are the average person's lungs?
That's a great question. So obviously, in order to be an organ donor, all organ donors go through a battery of testing to ensure that their organs are healthy enough for transplant. Everybody's organs have a little bit of wear and tear from their life experiences, whether they lived in a city or more rural, in terms of what they're breathing in. But there is a lot of testing, both invasive and non-invasive, to make sure that those organs are healthy for transplant.
Hmm. What is our transplant? And I'm going to ask this of both of you, but let's take lung transplants just because we've been talking about them more recently here. Are there lung transplants for children? Or what's the difference between transplants for adults and children?
Yeah, so pediatric lung transplant, fortunately, is much less common in general. The need in that population isn't as great. It's typically a disease that develops more with aging. There are some unique conditions in the very, very young, so infancy, due to congenital issues, either genetic or anatomical, and those are quite unique. The second population is children who either have cystic fibrosis or develop interstitial lung disease. There's kind of a third population that's becoming more common when adolescents develop what's called ARDS, which is a big inflammatory reaction in their lungs, typically to an infection such as influenza or another virus. And that can cause lung failure where they suddenly get really sick and then need a transplant. At UW Health, we do adolescent lung transplants, so typically age 12 on up, in order to provide access to the adolescent population.
Dr. Odorico, what about on the pancreas side?
Yes, yeah, Larry. So we are one of six programs in the nation that provides pediatric transplants for all of the solid organ transplants. And so we've performed pediatric pancreas transplants. But again, as Dr. Lowry said, it's relatively rare and only less than one a year, basically. So just a handful over the years. And over the course of the 30 years or so of 2000 total pancreas transplants, nearly, that we've performed at the University of Wisconsin, only a handful for pediatric patients, and most of those in adolescents. And it has to do with the fact of if they, the particular adolescent, due to a variety of reasons, cannot handle the technology and are really running into harm's way with regard to severe hypoglycemic events, 911 calls, ER visits, EMT calls, seizures, accidents, those sorts of things are indications to then we get a pancreas transplant. So the control of our blood sugars is automatic. We don't need technology. We don't need to monitor our blood sugars. That's the goal, is to completely eliminate insulin, normalize the hemoglobin A1C, get rid of the technology, and have the freedom to eat and drink and travel wherever one and whatever one wants to do. So that can be life-changing for an adolescent as well. But the downside is a lifetime of anti-rejection medicines. Hmm. So the stakes are a little bit higher with regard to the risks of long-term immunosuppression, but the outcomes can be excellent and can really give freedom to those patients in terms of cure of diabetes.
Well, it's nice to know that it's rare in both cases with the lungs and with the pancreas, but it's also nice to know that if it's your child that has one of those conditions, it can be taken care of, which is great, great news, or it can be at least. Dr. Aaron Lowry, Medical Director of the UW Health Lung Transplant Program, one of our guests. The other, Dr. John Oderico, General Surgeon at UW Health, specializing in kidney, pancreas, and islet transplant surgeries. And again, you can call numbers 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at lung transplants and also at pancreas and eye transplant surgeries with our guests today, Dr. John Oderico from UW Health and Dr. Aaron Lowry, Medical Director of the UW Health Lung Transplant Program. A listener couldn't stay with us. They're wondering, what can you do to prepare before an organ transplant? It might be different depending. Dr. Oderico, start with you.
Yeah, a great question, because it's so important that, let's call it prehabilitation, is so important for successful outcomes. So healthy living, healthy eating, and exercise to get as fit as possible. Good blood sugar control in the case of diabetes is specifically important to avoid or minimize the risk of infections after transplant. So, getting the education and knowledge about what to expect and how to manage anti-rejection medicines and what to other aspects of care mm-hmm. post-transplant. So getting some education and getting fitter, essentially.
Yeah. Dr. Lowry?
Yeah, I cannot overemphasize what Dr. Oderico just said, which is to get strong enough for the surgery. Exercise is so important to prepare for the lung transplant surgery. Enrolling in pulmonary rehab and really listening to what they say and taking that to your everyday, trying to do that exercise. Exercise is really hard when you have advanced lung disease and you're on oxygen, for sure. But you can't improve the lungs, but you can improve how the muscles use oxygen. And it helps to make patients feel better once they get over that initial hump of getting back into exercise. They actually feel a little bit better. And going into the surgery, they will be much stronger. Having a diet that is good nutrition, as well as mental health support and support from friends and family are also very, very important to the success of the transplant. And you want to make sure that you're up to date on all of your routine health maintenance items. So things like vaccines, colonoscopy screens, dental care, making sure that you're doing all of those things so that you're as healthy as possible going into that surgery.
Yeah, all good points. Jim in Ripon, the Green Lake area, has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Larry, I'm a Alpha-1 antitrypsin patient who is a ZZ. And so I'm 70 years old, and you reach a point when your lung function decreases where you sort of have to make a decision on which path do you take. So in the ZZ world, my FEV1 now is about 8.8, which will mean something to the doctor. But it seems to me if you go the route of a lung transplant, you can be trading off for one benefit but taking some other dynamics on that you aren't dealing with currently. And I'm just wondering, from the doctor's perspective, how do you determine what's the best path to take?
That is a fantastic question. And I think really knowledge is power, right? So you're in the driver's seat as the patient, and you should consider meeting with the lung transplant team, but also the palliative care team to understand the path ahead and the different decisions that need to be made, and understand, you know, what are your goals? What are your aims in the time that you have left? And the decision will become much more clear once you understand what is involved with both pathways.
So sit down with both. You need to sit down with both. And so it'd be two different teams, I guess.
Yeah, it would be two different teams. But I think to make it simple, just, you know, you can meet with the lung transplant team to understand what is all involved with lung transplant to better understand, is it the right path for you in your case?
Jim, good luck. I'm sorry for your situation, but thank you so much for calling, and good luck with your future treatments. Appreciate it very much. What kind of need is there for organ donors in Wisconsin? How are we as a state when it comes to that? Dr. Lowry, we'll go to you. What do you think? I'm sure it could be better, but
it can always be better. And so it's important that when people are thinking about transplant, thinking about the other side of that, if there is a situation where you can consider being a donor, there are living donors for things like kidney transplant. And then there is also deceased donors. And so what is important, the donors have so generously given life to our patients. And in many instances, it has resulted from a tragic situation into something that is some good and such a precious gift to so many people around the country. And so what people should do if they are considering being an organ donor, register as an organ donor, sign your license, let your friends and family know this is what you want to do. This is part of your life and who you are and what you want to do, and you're not here and able to speak for yourself.
And I can tell you, as someone who's had a cornea transplant from a donor and a bone marrow transplant in my finger from a different donor, I'm a 3-in-1 kind of person here. I really appreciate and have appreciated very much the sacrifices of those folks, and a chance to be able to write letters anonymously to recipients and thank them for their donations was something I was really more than happy to do. And you folks are doing some wonderful work here. We should be so proud of what we have with these transplants. And I want to thank you both very, very much for the work you do and for being with us today. Thank you both very, very much. Appreciate it. Dr. Aaron Lowry, Medical Director of the UW Health Lung Transplant Program, and Dr. John Odorico, General Surgeon at UW Health, specializes in kidney, pancreas, and islet transplant surgeries. Great to have them with us. And we're great to have a great team of people here on the show to produce these programs. Our producers, Clara Kniper, Joel Patnott, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.